Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned. What you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, movie fans. The Top 100 Project is with you again, and thanks for listening to us. All right, so last week's coming attractions trivia question for this movie, which is Yankee Doodle Dandy, was which Yankee Doodle Dandy actor was also in two other AFI films during the 1940s? Bev, what is the answer?
Well, I know it's not James Cagney because this is the only AFI film that he appears in. Mm-hmm. And you say actor, so I'm guessing that that narrows it down to dudes?
Hmm. I would have phrased it the same way if it had been a woman, but okay. It is a man.
Okay, well, you just narrowed that down for me then. I have to guess. I'm going to say Walter Huston.
You are correct.
Yes!
He had his cameo in Maltese Falcon.
Did he?
Yeah, he was Jacoby, the one who brings the Falcon to...
Oh my god, of
Sam
course.
Spade's office.
Of course.
And of course, he's the father in this movie, and he is in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre in 1948.
There you go. Oh, I should have remembered that even from Maltese Falcon.
We said starting this decade that there were not a lot of films in the 40s on the AFI list, and there was one guy who's in three of them. So, the Top 100 Project's 30th movie is Yankee Doodle a Dandy. The movie was 100th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list. One notch behind Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but danced up a couple spots to 98th in 2007, between 2007 Newbies, Toy Story, and Blade Runner. Yankee Doodle Dandy premiered on May 29th, 1942. Then Warner Brothers gave all Jimmy Cagney fans a chance to see it on June 6th. The flick rocked the box office that summer and raked in a ton of dollars. Bev will give us the skinny.
Biographical musical based on the life of George M. Cohan, played by James Cagney, follows the legendary Broadway hoofer from childhood, where he performed with his sister and his parents, up to America's difficult early days of World War II.
In a nutshell, Dancer reassures wartime president that America's gonna be all right. I do love that part. We got this thing licked. Don't you worry, Mr. President.
Thanks, Dancer Man.
Retired Dancer Man.
Well, if a Broadway actor said we're going to be okay.
All right, Bab, our first musical in quite a while. What did you think of YDD?
Well, first I have to say it bears the distinction of being one of the funnest titles to say on the list.
It's hardest to say. I keep stumbling over it.
No, I love it. Yankee Doodle Dandy. It's so much fun. Anyways, so this movie has a ton of stuff that I generally, as a rule, can't stand. Like, it's not remotely challenging to its audience, and it's relatively free of conflict. It's over the top patriotic to the point that is absurdly ridiculous. It's a biopic, and I rarely like biopics, yet I really enjoyed it. I don't think I liked it in the first half hour, and it just grew on me, and then by the end I just thoroughly enjoyed the experience of watching it. And I think I would give the credit to a combination of being very competently directed and just the enormous, overwhelming charisma of James Cagney as the star.
We're not going to have to talk about the other actors all that much because he is the story. He's the star. He is by far the best thing in this movie.
Yeah.
We haven't had a movie like that since, I guess, one of the
Jazz
Chaplin
singer, maybe?
Maybe one of the Chaplin films, actually.
Oh, yeah.
His female co-stars were good in those films, but it was Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
You said a few minutes ago as well that this is Cagney's only AFI. He actually, I think we talked about it at the time, Mutiny on the Bounty has a really small cameo because he'd worked with the director a few times and was nearby when they were shooting some scenes. And he said, put me in a scene in the background somewhere. So it's some uncredited cameo in that movie that I don't even know where he is.
Sure, but he doesn't even have a speaking line, right?
So this is really his only AFI.
Mm-hmm.
Cagney was a giant star. He was in the top 25 of the top 50 actors and actresses list, which isn't exactly surprising. And for those who maybe don't know his work that well, he's the guy in Public Enemy, rubbing the grapefruit in Mae Clark's face.
I've never seen Public Enemy, but every film class I ever took had a book that referenced that very scene.
It was his star-making performance, too. And he made many other gangster flicks in the 30s and into the 40s. Not a lot of musicals, incidentally. He made a movie called Footlight Parade, which was a musical. I don't know if he ever made any others, though, beyond these two.
But he got his start as a stage performer, isn't that right?
I think I read that
somewhere. That's where, yeah. I mean, he obviously learned to dance somewhere, and then he is a hell of a dancer.
Mm-hmm. But what a contrast, though. And he wins the Oscar. We didn't say that yet. He won the Oscar for this performance, his only ever win, doing something that he wasn't known for. Which is not uncommon, actually.
Yeah, the Oscars love rewarding people for...
A comedic actor winning for that drama performance.
Yeah, going against type, like doing something out of your comfort zone is definitely...
Yeah, Tom Hanks in Philadelphia is a great example of that. He's playing a drama where he's dying of a horrible disease. Let's give him an award. But yeah, Cagney. So he was in other films that I love later, more so than Public Enemy or Yankee Doodle Dandy or the gangster films, as famous as they are, as popular as they are. It is a gangster film, but it came a little late after this one. And that was White Heat,
mm-hmm.
which if you haven't seen, we got to make a point of seeing that someday. He was magnetic in that film, more so than almost any other.
Oh, I believe it.
And he also made Mr. Roberts, and that was a supporting part of that, with Henry Fonda and Jack Lemmon were the main stars there. And 1, 2, 3 with Billy Wilder, and ended his career with a small role in Ragtime in 1981. So he worked for about 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was, in this film, the Raggedy Andy of musical performers. From the waist down, anyway.
Yeah, but he's very carefully mimicking the style of Cohan.
You said you looked that up on YouTube, and you actually saw Cohan.
I found a performance that Cohan did, and apparently, as much as the details of Cohan's life are treated very casually, as far as accuracy,
they get rid of one of his wives.
That's
not the first time Hollywood's ever done that. I know,
it's crazy because his marriage and the wholesomeness of his marriage is such a big point of the film, that he meets his wife when he's a teenager and they stay married very happily. Like, when I say there's no conflict in this film, there's no conflict in this film. And then to read that not only was that not true, but he had a divorce. And he wasn't actually born on the 4th of July, and a few other details, playing with time. They really didn't care that much about being accurate as far as those details went, but apparently they cared a great deal about being extremely accurate when it came to recreating the performances, the stage performances.
Mm-hmm.
And Cagney is a dead ringer. Like, if you look up that performance, the one that was, it's the only existing film performance that Cohan did, which incidentally he did in blackface. Jeez.
Yeah, we haven't seen blackface in a little bit, and now we're seeing it again.
Oh god.
First you see it briefly in the background of Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then you see
the four Cohans
actually perform for a good minute of the film in that blackface.
I mean, I guess when that performance is meant to take place, it's during a time when blackface was still prevalent in vaudeville.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I saw this old performance of Cohan's, and James Cagney, it's a perfect match. He nails it. And I really liked the style of dancing that he did. I thought it's
very different than what you usually see in musicals.
Yeah.
Fred Astaire is who the studio wanted,
mm-hmm.
and Astaire is maybe the greatest dancer who ever did that on film. But from what I've ever seen of Astaire, and if you're saying that Cagney and Cohan were the same kind of person, then Astaire would have been wrong for the role, unless he would have been willing to adapt his style.
Oh, he probably could have. I'm sure if anybody could have pulled it off, it would have been Astaire. But I don't know if Astaire would have had the acting chops to do what Cagney did, which was just to embody him so perfectly, like just that arrogant, flamboyant, and I said it before, extremely charismatic. He's really, really winning in this
His movie. Energy is just off the charts.
Oh, yeah. It's really, really fun to watch.
It's like he's drawing the other performers out even more. The most famous person in the movie, other than him, acting-wise, is, of course, as we said, Walter Huston. And even Walter Huston doesn't really stand up that much.
No, he doesn't. Nobody does. Which I guess is appropriate for the subject matter. George M. Cohan would have been like that. This movie does seem to perfectly represent Cohan's personality. He was obsessed with the stage. He lived and breathed on the stage. It was his entire life was wrapped up in performing. So for the movie to concentrate more on recreating performances, that makes sense. He was a totally perfect American, I guess you could say, or at least for the image that they wanted that Americans to portray. It is a very... like I said, exceptionally, embarrassingly patriotic. So over the top that it's almost ridiculous. Anyone who hasn't seen the film, Cohan was responsible for writing Grand Old Flag and Over There and the song Yankee Doodle Dandy. Like, these are all standards now, American standards, and they are so over the top patriotic, which apparently he really was.
Well, this is the ultimate flag waving movie outside of a Rocky sequel. Especially Rocky IV. Where at the end, Stallone literally drapes himself in the American flag.
in case there was any ambiguity.
The movie may be in black and white, but you can smell red, white, and blue paint all over every backdrop and set decoration,
too. Oh, my God. Yeah, they lay it on thick, thick, thick.
All right. Now, let me address a review by Bosley Crowther, mm-hmm. very famous critic from the 30s and 40s and so on. New York Times review, so the actual 1942 review. And he said the movie is a, quote, corking good entertainment and as affectionate, if not as accurate, a film biography as has ever, yes, ever, been made. He also says, and the only elaborate flag waving is done in one gaudy production sequence based on the song Your Grand Old Flag. That's not true.
Yeah.
This movie is constantly waving the flag.
The first scene where he's born on the 4th of July, where, incidentally, I have to point
out. First trivia question.
Oh, okay,
when
fine.
Was the real George M. Cohan actually born?
Oh, you know, I saw that he wasn't born on 4th of July, but what I read didn't actually say when he was born.
Take a guess.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
It's very close to that day.
It's for the 3rd of July.
You're correct.
Oh, really? Yes.
Bonus question. What year was he born?
Oh, curses. 18. If he was in his 60s in the 40s, then that isn't even necessarily accurate. I'll say 1875.
We are very close.
Really?
1878.
Wow. I am so smart. I'm doing better already in the trivia, even though I've got those questions kind of wrong. I'm still doing better than I do in most podcasts.
Indeed. Well, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that in 3 of the 30 AFI movies we've watched so far, there have been scenes where a performer has had to miss something exceptionally important because of stage performance. And in all 3 of those movies, there was also blackface. You have the jazz singer where, and I guess this just speaks to how heartless theater managers were at the time, because you have the jazz singer where they're like, your dad's dying? Too bad. Get to work. And then you have Swing Time where they're like, it's your wedding day? Too bad.
Get to work.
Get to work. You could have scheduled your wedding on a day when you weren't performing, but you didn't. Get to work. And then you have, again, your wife.
Yeah, Jerry Cohen.
Your wife is in labor. No, this vaudeville show can't survive without a leprechaun act. Get to work. Like, yeah. They couldn't have done without the tap dancing leprechaun for one performance. They did without whatever mom did.
Yeah, because she was part of the performance.
Yeah,
too.
But I honestly, after seeing these 3 films, I'm a little surprised that she didn't perform through childbirth.
That's part of the production. The kid falling on stage out of her.
Well,
what a twist!
But they do give you the impression that he was probably born tap dancing on stage, earning money for vaudeville. But yes, and that does give us an opportunity to talk about blackface.
It was just what they did in vaudeville. I mean, we talked about it in the other podcast that had blackface, and we talked about Racism and Gone with the Wind and other films too. I don't know how many more times we're going to have to deal with this subject. I think a lot. We will get racially charged movies, especially in the 60s. And the movies we've talked about so often have not been about race.
Mm-hmm.
But people didn't have common sense back then. They still weren't humans to so many people. And not to pick on the South yet again, but especially there.
Oh, yeah. And so a big part of,
as lousy as that is, that was just the way America still was.
And like part of the reason why blackface was offensive and is still offensive is because it was part of the propaganda tool that kept them second-class citizens, to belittle black culture and black people. And they had tons of horrible stereotypes and tropes of characters. It really is a particularly ugly part of American heritage. I mean, the word Jim Crow comes from common blackface character, and it's the notion is that they are buffoons, that they are not intelligent enough or competent enough to have all the same rights and privileges as white people. And it's like a pretty despicable part of American culture and history,
which they just as soon forget as much as possible.
Well, not in the 40s though. Not yet. They hadn't gotten there yet. I guess, it's way pre-civil rights. Yeah, now they would just assume.
Although a movie like 12 Years a Slave, which we reviewed a few weeks ago on our Now Playing project, brings it all to light in a much different way. But that's pretty deep for what we're talking about now.
Yeah.
This movie is trying to be patriotic through and through. All right, we haven't had a sponsor in a while, but we do this week.
Oh, good.
Here we go. Yankee Doodle Dandy is brought to you by USA! USA!
USA!
USA!
USA!
USA! Oh no! You left me hanging! It's funny because, like, patriotism is usually something I find insulting and over the top, especially laid on as thick as Yankee Doodle Dandy does.
In the last 12 years, we've seen way too much of it.
Yeah, and I usually find it just kind of, it is kind of by its nature propaganda, and when you're media savvy like we are, it's kind of hard to enjoy it on the level it's meant to be enjoyed. But I say that to say, like, for some reason, I felt like this movie was an exception, and I can't necessarily put my finger on why, but I guess that has something to do with the fact that the movie isn't presenting this to us without comment. It's more about the mechanism of how this, I don't want to say propaganda, it kind of sounds more scandalous than I mean it to
be. It was propaganda, but
it was propaganda.
At the end of the movie, it is about trying to get support and people even more ready to go fight for freedom in Europe, which most people will say was a just cause. There will always be somebody that will say, even that wasn't just, like modern days with Iraq.
Even the fact that you just worded it, fight for freedom in Europe, is like a kind of...
That's propaganda right there.
Yeah, that's a propaganda turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But we were fighting against the Nazis and then in Asia against the Japanese.
And the movie Italians also deals with the World War I as well, that he...
Right.
He himself tried to sign up, and then when they wouldn't let him, they're like, you're way too important to us here, and then he writes over there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this scene itself, I laughed out loud when we were watching it, because it's just, like, and I think I said at the time, you know, people should turn around after watching this scene and watch All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Be like, maybe the soldiers do deserve a little more credit than the song and dance man who got all these people to enlist.
Or even a movie that doesn't literally take from this movie, but Born on the 4th of July, the Oliver Stone movie.
Oh, yeah,
guy who's just like Cohan. He wants to go
extremely
fight for his country.
Yeah.
And Ron Kovic goes over there and comes back a much-changed man.
Yeah.
One of Stone's best movies, I think, and one of Tom Cruise's best performances.
But Yankee Doodle Dandy is certainly not interested in dealing with the nuance of war and whether or not people should be fighting it. And as much as it brings these things up, it's just kind of presenting them to you as an aspect of Cohan's life more than anything. Like it's about that because those are the subjects that Cohan sang about and made plays about, but it really is just about the life and times of a performer.
There are two things I want to say about this point we're making about the patriotism. One is the movie itself was undoubtedly Warner Brothers, Michael Curtiz, the director. We haven't said his name after all this time. We'll talk about him a little more in a minute. And the writers and everybody involved, Cagney, of course, undoubtedly were trying to support their country in a war that was actually happening.
Yeah, right, this movie was released during the Second World War.
They were making it when America had been in a war for not even a year. So there's that. They're trying to be a propaganda machine in a positive way about a guy who was a propaganda machine. The second thing is, I think the things that made Americans as cynical as they are about this kind of patriotism were events in the 60s and maybe in the modern era as well, but especially when Kennedy was killed and then when his brother and MLK were killed. And Watergate. And Vietnam,
Vietnam
as well.
Yeah.
People would have believed in any president back then more so. From what I've heard, I mean, I wasn't even alive in the 60s. But they would have had faith in Eisenhower more than they ever would in Obama or Bush or the modern presidents. A Democrat could say, well, Eisenhower's my president. Or I really hope back in those days at least that a Republican could say, well, Kennedy's my president, and now it's Lyndon Johnson. And in the end, I want my country to do well, unlike what we hear all the time now, which is the complete opposite of that.
Yeah.
So I think that those events and so many other things, that this movie, which is 71 years old, that kind of thing was just easier to do, and almost everyone would have been way more into it.
Yeah, it was like the nature of politics. It was the nature of the press. It was the nature of probably education at the time. And even just, like you say, the state of the world. Of course, World War One made people cynical, but the 60s really did seem to knock morale down so much so
especially for young people. I think a lot of young people would have felt like, what's the point of believing anymore?
But it's hard for people like you and I, who are in our 30s, to imagine what the world was like when people could unironically sing Yankee Doodle Dandy or She's a Grand Old Flag, when they would actually go pay money to see these plays. These plays that Cohan produced were enormous hits. People loved this patriotic, would now consider it just like embarrassing claptrap. It's just so silly. I can't imagine even the most patriotic American really getting into this stuff the way apparently the masses did back then. But like you say, a lot of the world's changed so much and become so cynical. But it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that when Cohan was famous, and it wasn't like that even in the 40s when this movie came out.
Okay, so here's a trivia question. Number two.
All right.
There's a big number in the movie, and it's called Yankee Doodle Boy. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is extremely flag-waving. So, what is the actual name of the Yankee Doodle Boy in Cohan's signature number? The character's name that Cagney's playing, Cohan's playing.
Oh my gosh.
Very all-American name.
Yeah. I have no idea. I don't remember.
Johnny Jones.
Oh, yes.
And then that should lead us into the cast. I mean, let's not spend much time on this because with respect to them, they didn't really impact the movie. We said that already. Walter Huston plays the father, Jerry. Joan Leslie plays George's wife, Mary. Mary and Jerry. Rosemary DeCamp plays Nellie, his mother. Jean Cagney, Jimmy's own sister, plays Josie Cohan, his sister in the film. And his brother, William, was an associate producer. Richard Worf had a pretty good role as Sam Harris. He's the guy who becomes Cagney's partner. He probably has as much screen time in the second half as anybody other than Cagney and, I guess, Joan Leslie playing the wife. Mm-hmm. He's in it quite a bit. And then we're going to see this guy in next week's AFI movie, Casablanca, S.Z. Sakal. He plays Schwab. He's the one that Cohan kisses on the top hat when they sign a deal, when Harris and Cohan sign a deal with him.
That was such a cute, hilarious moment. Yeah. It really surprised me. Mm-hmm.
But they, ultimate examples of supporting players. They're enabling their stars are supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. And none of them really were standouts, especially not compared to Cagney.
I love the line that Mary has, though, when she first meets George. I know I have talent, even if I am from Buffalo. As people who live not too far from Buffalo and how they can be kind of annoying about their bills and their sabers and their bisons. I've never been a big fan of that city. I have no reason to dislike them, I guess. It's kind of stupid to even say that. But I did laugh at that number, that line, because of that cruelty to poor Buffalo. Well, you know, George is thinking with his lower extremities, a la Charles Foster Kane, in his efforts to make Mary a star. Because she really doesn't have much talent.
She is from Buffalo.
And she's pretty... She's pretty oblivious to when she meets him. He's got old man makeup on. He must be 95 years old.
Doesn't she start crying when she realizes who he really is and gets faint? What's wrong with her?
She's the most naive person who wants to be in show business in the history of the world.
Yeah, well, at least she realizes she's better off as the world's most supportive wife.
Mm-hmm. Even though he gives her song to someone else.
That is a pretty cute scene with the flowers and the candy.
Yeah.
I completely fell for it had a great laugh at the end.
I wouldn't throw you over for a bigger star. Actually, rather, I hope you wouldn't throw me over for a bigger star.
Well, let's just hope that a bigger star doesn't come along, Ryan.
You want to do old movie podcasts?
Who's a big star of movie podcasts?
I'll look that up.
Yeah.
The other line I think that was memorable is that right at the beginning of the movie, a critic comes out of the show. Trivia question number three.
Okay.
Let me get back to that critic's line in a second. So, what is the name of the show, the Broadway show at the beginning of the film?
Like the very beginning, before he meets the president?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd Rather Be Right.
There you go.
All right. I thought I was out with trivia with the last one, but yes!
He plays Roosevelt, and he's singing and dancing, and as we certainly learned many years later, Roosevelt was in a wheelchair through most or all of his presidency.
Isn't it a line from the campaign, I'd rather be right than president? In a debate or something, somebody challenged Roosevelt with a question about whether he would follow his conscience or follow what people are going to vote for, and he said, I'd rather be right than president, something to that effect.
It's a good line.
Yeah, I'm sure that somebody who knows what I'm talking about is cringing right now at my terrible description of those events, but...
All right, so back to the critic's line at the beginning of the movie, this other quote I like so much. They come out of the show, the two critics, and the one says, I like it, so I guess I'll pan it. There's so many movie critics now who probably think that without actually saying it.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard that when film critics all get together for a screening, however many might be in a screening room, and they'll all be laughing at that Adam Sandler comedy and then come out and write the review, and it's the stupidest movie of the year. I think Larry King is one that revealed that all these people in there, they're laughing with me, and then suddenly they're writing with these negative reviews.
Insulted.
So that may be looking to the future with that critic's line.
Well, and I'm sure Cohan, because he was really pandering to broad audiences, obviously. So, yeah, any highbrow critic would go in and enjoy something that's just kind of dumb and basic and meant to appeal to the lowest common denominator. And they can't, yeah, they can't like it.
Well, and speaking of the critics, Coen has the same problem that Sullivan had in our previous podcast, Sullivan's Travels. He does lightweight material, but wants to be taken seriously by critics.
Yeah.
And like Sullivan, he gets over it quickly.
Oh, yeah, that was like the one scene when his dramatic play flops. I was like, finally, something's going to challenge this guy for more than 5 minutes of screen time. But then it's immediately overtaken. He's like, the critics are finally going to nail me. And then war breaks out and they're like, awesome. Not a problem. We're back in it. Because truly, like this, it could have been a fault of the film. But somehow it wasn't, which is just the fact that there's no arching conflict whatsoever. There's everything that goes wrong for him is solved in the same scene that the problem is introduced, it seems.
Yeah.
Other than like some brief struggles with his ego that kind of wind up playing in his favor.
And he gets beat on by his father because child abuse is such a larf.
Then again, I know, it's really not.
He does get spanked. I mean, yeah. I was spanked and not often. I was a pretty good kid, but when I was, it was for the right reason.
Yeah, so. It was a spanking. I guess like, we've certainly seen a far worse example of spousal abuse and child neglect.
And who is young George playing in that show that turns him into a bit of a monster for a little while?
Oh, it's like...
What's the name of the play?
Oh, curses.
Three-word title. The first one is the last name of a big star.
That is a really convoluted clue. Monroe. Something Monroe. I don't know.
She wasn't around
yet. I give up.
Pecks. So Gregory Peck.
Oh.
Peck's bad boy.
Okay. Fine. You just have to nail me on the trivia. You can't let me be a winner just once.
You've had a few winners all right today.
But yeah, I kind of liked that nature. Like I said, it won me over. And then it occurred to me after we saw it that in a way it kind of mimics a vaudeville show. Because a vaudeville show would have just included a bunch of short acts, like a bunch of conflicts that would have been resolved very quickly, and then you introduce a new conflict. And since their goal in the movie was really to mimic a stage performance, maybe that was an intentional thing that they did. They just wanted his life to be a bunch of vaudeville-style vignettes.
Mm-hmm. Well, incidentally, this is the first biography on the list. There are no more biographical films on the top 100 until we get to the 50s and early 60s, the late 50s and early 60s, with Ben-Hur, Spartacus, mm-hmm. Lawrence of Arabia, all epics, much different than Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, yeah. I always say that biopics, I'm not a fan of biopics, because it's really, really hard to do well, because a person's life, if you want to really tell it properly...
Especially if they're still alive, as Coen was.
Sure, but I mean, a person's life from birth to death, or their significant... events in their lives, they usually just don't follow the pattern of entertaining storytelling. You know, you don't get a clean beginning, middle, end. People's lives don't really lend themselves to an entertaining story all that often.
Or what you get with modern musical biopics like Ray and Walk the Line that were released back-to-back, mm-hmm. not 2004, 2005. Both really solid, good movies with some great performances by the actors, but they were the same story. It was almost literally the same story, and that's maybe why Walk the Line didn't get quite the same kind of raves that Ray did. Everyone's mm-hmm. thinking, well, we just saw this last winter.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of movies do have that same sort of arc.
It seems to increase the odds that you're going to have a biopic made about you if you're a musician when you have a substance abuse problem.
Definitely, especially now. Well, you talked about how it's hard to make these kinds of movies because you've got to show all the highlights, and that seems a little bit disingenuous. Mm-hmm. No one's life is all highlights. But there's a moment in the film that reminded me of a line that you had about Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. You said that Susan Kane doing puzzles in the mansion is your dream life.
Yeah.
Well, mine has now happened, Yankee Doodle Dandy, only a few movies later. Mine is reading trade papers in a hammock.
What was the headline again?
Oh, chicks, nicks, slicks, picks.
Yeah,
picks,
yeah.
Wicks, something else I forget now.
You and hammocks.
Love a hammock. I will have a hammock when we are old, if not sooner.
What are we waiting for? You know, you're not that young, Ryan.
All right, we mentioned Michael Curtiz a little bit ago, and he is the director. He's also the director of Casablanca, which is our next AFI film.
Yeah, back to back.
Back to back from Michael. He also directed The Adventures of Robin Hood, Captain Blood, and Mildred Pierce. Really good journeyman director. He did win the Oscar for Casablanca, so he had that on his mantle for the rest of his life. The writers were Robert Buckner and Edmund Joseph, neither of whom wrote another film of much significance. One of them wrote for Laurel and Hardy at some point in his career. And then Hal B. Wallace was a producer. Jack Warner got producer production credit. He was the big boss at Warner's. And then I definitely have to mention these guys, the Epstein brothers, Philip and Julius, who contributed uncredited to the script. And then they wrote with Howard Koch,
that's right.
The very next movie, Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
The other technical people I definitely want to talk about, even more so than the ones we just mentioned, James Wong Howe, mm-hmm. the cinematographer. He was one of the absolute greats. The guy worked for over 50 years in the business, started in the silent era, and he photographed some of the unsung classics like HUD, which won him an Oscar, The Thin Man, and Sweet Smell of Success, which I've mentioned more than once in this podcast, and we are going to watch sometime.
One of these days, we are going to watch that movie.
And Howe also did classics like Picnic and The Old Man and the Sea, which I hate. Oh, God. It's one of the worst voiceover narration of all time. The other behind-the-scenes guy I definitely want to mention is Don Siegel, because he's the future director of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 1956 version, and Dirty Harry. Good genre director. And he did the montages, and he also did montages for, say it with me, Casablanca. He didn't say it with me.
Oh, I didn't know where you were going with it. I was really curious to see what you were talking about. I will pay a brief compliment to the montages. They actually are really well done. I particularly like the montage of the Broadway marquees. I thought that was neat. I don't think we'd seen anything quite like that in the project so far.
Yeah. Let's name drop one more big name from our modern era. John Travolta. He says this is his favorite movie.
Really?
He and his family grew up, he said it on the Actors Studio many years ago, that he's family, and he grew up loving this movie. And he talked about it at length.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's a real pleasure. It's an absolute delight.
And Travolta is one of the great dancers of our lifetime.
Yeah.
All right, so the awards and other AFI lists. This movie won 3 Oscars. We mentioned Cagney's Best Actor win is only one. It won for Best Music Score, and it also won for Best Sound. It was nominated for 5 others.
Mm.
As well, and it made the infamous National Film Registry, Congress is preserving this movie, did that in 1993.
I'm surprised that it took them 4 years to get around to something this America-centered.
For Congress to do that. All right, so the movie was 97th on the top 100 movie quotes list for My Mother Thanks You, My Father Thanks You, My Sister Thanks You, and I Thank You. It was 88th on the top 100 Cheers. A little surprising, it wasn't much higher than 88th.
Yeah.
It was 71st on the top 100 songs for The Yankee Doodle Boy, and 18th on the top 25 musicals, one of those online lists they did that was never a special.
Yeah.
So that's it for Yankee Doodle Dandy. 98th, 100th on the 2 different lists. Makes the list at least. What do you think of that?
I don't think if I was making the list myself, I would put this movie on, but I kind of have a hard time thinking of why it doesn't belong there. If it's something, you know, that musical buffs and extremely patriotic Americans enjoy, then power to them.
It also
and
gets,
James Cagney's
performance. It gets Cagney in there because otherwise he wouldn't be. Another movie that's right near it on the first list is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I said it was it was back-to-back with it on the 98 list. It isn't on the 2007 list. When we get to that movie, we'll obviously talk about that. And in that process, Spencer Tracy, and Will Poitier too, yeah. But then Poitier was in the Heat of the Night, the second list. But my point is that Spencer Tracy had only one movie in the original list. It was almost not on it, and then he wasn't on the second one at all.
Mm-hmm.
So at least they were both represented the first time, Cagney and Tracy. So up next on the Top 100 project is some piece of crap called. Say it with me. Say it ahead of me.
Casablanca.
There it is. That one's going to be tough because, as we said about Citizen Kane and Wizard of Oz and some other ones, what do you say about movies that people have talked about to death over the years? Well, we'll try to find a way to do it.
Yeah.
So the coming attractions trivia question for that movie is, Casablanca takes place in Morocco, which makes it the first AFI movie to be set entirely in Africa. What's the next AFI picture to be set on the Dark Continent?
I have a guess, but I'll save it.
As you should.
Yes.
See if anyone can guess before we get to it. So that's next week.
In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Over there,
the military industrial complex won't let us stop funding over there. And cut.